welcome to the Missiology podcast post-game. This is Martin Rodriguez with
Greg McKenzie. Welcome back. We're excited to talk about Scott Sundquist and his insightful and interesting interview with Martin.
We apologize for the length of that podcast, but we just thought it was all wonderful and we didn't want to cut anything. So that's why you got a 57-minute podcast with Dr. Sundquist.
Yeah, I couldn't bring myself to cut many pieces of it. It was too engaging. So I thought, well, you know, listeners can always pause whenever they're done. we'll leave the control in your hands rather than cutting it out for you.
Well, there is just so many things for me personally, Greg, there are so many things that I loved about his interview. I go back and I listen to his interview and the time flies. I just enjoy hearing about it. One of the things that I enjoy hearing about, maybe we can just dive right in if you're up for it.
Let's do it.
One of the things that I love is just hearing his methodology as a historian. And that was something that I also, you and I chatted about this a little bit, but that was something that stood out to you as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'm impressed with the way that he talked about as a historian trained in, you know, relatively modernist methods, and with that comes an immanent frame, right? You don't think of the events in history as the actions of God, and he talked about, you know, demon possession and like the things that happen aren't interpreted in a way that would give the Spirit of God credit or that would understand the agency of God. And so I really like the way that he talked about getting out of that, but still wanting to do legitimate, rigorous historical scholarship. And so it was nice to hear him say, like, of course, people say stupid stuff too. Like, you have to think about what's really going on here, and not everything is legitimate just because you're willing to admit and look for the agency of God. But that also doesn't bring you to the other extreme where you just say everything is purely immanent and there's no spirit at work.
Yeah, I found that very powerful, very refreshing. And I think that focus for him is something that, I mean, for instance, I love that is, he talks about his evangelism class and, you know, he's in a secular enlightenment context and he's teaching a class on evangelism. And one of his statements says he's talking about the class that's across the hall. And, they just found out that there's no need for evangelism because we're all saved. All we need is dialogue. And I love his statement that, you know, for me, this is all about providing people an opportunity to look into the face of Jesus, give everyone a chance to say yes to him.
Yeah, he's obviously an evangelical. He believes that Jesus is not only true, but necessary. And that shapes the reading of history. I mean, it's a theological lens that of faith, right? A faith in Jesus that you bring to the project of telling history from a standpoint, and that lens is legitimate, and it's allowed in the mix of postmodern possibilities, and it enters dialogue from its standpoint.
For me, one of the things that as I'm working on my dissertation right now, one of the things that I am thinking about and thinking through is how often, even in missiology, within our own field, we have ways of talking about, you know, our methods, our practices, And we can talk about it, even things like contextualization. So you can go through an entire conversation about how to contextualize, and it doesn't actually take the agency of God seriously, right? I mean, you can actually have an entire conversation on some of these core concepts, and yet the methodology does not take into account that God is active on the ground, present in our lives, working, and wanting to dialogue with us. So I love that about Dr. Sundquist, and I love that is front and center. When he comes to history, he's coming with that perspective, with this orientation. God is he's shaping me, he's shaping you, he's active in history. And here are some of the ways that I see him as having been active in history. I love that.
Yeah, I do too. But it also, it raises this interesting dilemma in my mind. And so I'll just jump to something that stood out to me from the end of the interview when he's answering the question about the future of missiology. I found it super interesting that he was willing to put his finger on Zionism. And
that stood out to me as well. I was very excited about him saying that. I mean, you have to be brave because you don't want to be. Anyway, you get to your point. Sorry.
Well, it matters. But sometimes it's easy to kind of, I don't know, not pay attention to how much it matters. But the thing that the challenge that I felt like this created for the earlier conversation was that so much of evangelical or fundamentalist Zionism is about affirming a particularly spiritual reading of history, right? It's a way of saying, look, God is at work and we see these prophecies coming to fulfillment and these things are happening. And it's not just politics. It's God. God is the agent here.
Right.
And so there's this what I would think of as a sort of an uncritical version of that affirmation that creates problems. I mean, it certainly puts me on the side of saying, whoa, okay, let's step back. And I really appreciated him not only affirming as a historian the importance of his faith and the affirmation of God's agency in history, but also saying, look, there are some bad readings and they have stakes. It's very important for Christian mission in the 21st century that we jettison the Zionist agenda and understand everything that it means for mission. And you were telling me, you know, I'm not as familiar with you are as you are with the way that this is playing out in other places in the world as well that are very much into this agenda.
Yeah. One of the things that I was surprised by, so living in China between 2003, from 2003 to 2007, and then a year again in 2009 and 10, we would, our house churches, the networks that we were working with, often came in contact with other networks and other Christians. And I was so surprised to, again and again and again, to meet Chinese Christians. Some of them very new Christians, but fully indoctrinated in some ways in this Back to Jerusalem movement. They were fully conversant. They knew all of the verses and the passages that talk about, you know, how Christianity needs to make its way back to Jerusalem. And, you know, the message of Jesus needs to get back there. And there's this focus on that place, right? That the importance of the place, as Dr. Sundquist was talking about, and he calls it a false hope. And sometimes I would scratch my head and I'm like, you guys, where are you getting this, you know, back to Jerusalem idea? You know, these are Chinese from the middle of like Shandong province or, you know, Hubei province. And yet they share some of this, you know, Christian Zionist worldview, a reading that as he was pointing out, can be traced right back to the Scofield Bible, right? It hasn't been around forever and ever.
I find that historical perspective very valuable, right? Because to some extent, it can devolve into this almost impossible debate about the interpretation of certain passages, certain prophecies. But then when you add in this historical perspective, you can say, well, look, where is this coming from in the first place? When did this start? When did it become a live option? What are the influences? What are the political interests that we can actually describe historically? All that's really useful. And I know I'm, because I've been looking at this recently, just incidentally, I'm aware that there are a number of books that do precisely that. They try to lay out like an explanation of where this comes from. And so it's helpful to have a missiologist who is a historian as much as anything else in terms of scholarship. Say this, we need this awareness in missiology. We need to understand where this is coming from.
Yeah, but going back to your original point, it really is important, right, that he's living in that tension, right? History is, I'm not going to be approaching history from this enlightenment position, right? God's agency matters. Is, you know, let's not limit the power of the Holy Spirit at work in history. And yet, right, and he's speaking to, at the end, he's speaking to, you know, this jettisoning of Zionist interpretation of missiology, this that's grounded in many ways a charismatic worldview, right? That says God is doing something and we need to be attentive. And he's like, you know, yes, God is moving and we need to be attentive, but this, if anything, calls us back into dialogue, and, you know, we need frameworks for discernment. And as you said, you use the term critical, right? And let's have a, and again, this doesn't mean that these, that Christian Zionists aren't doing awesome things. They are, right? I mean, like, we know that people associated with these narratives are being used by God in many places around the world and are doing just fantastic things for the gospel. And yet so easily missiology or mission, I should say, within these narratives gets wedded to militarism, to nationalism, right? To some very racist or ethnocentric worldviews, and
at a very basic level, to injustice.
There you go.
Right, to injustices that, for all kinds of other theological and missiological reasons, one would have to say, no, there's an ideology to critique here. So that's the pressure that makes the dialogue necessary, not out of any sense of certainty or much less superiority, but that I have other commitments to the way of Jesus and my understanding of the kingdom of God that make certain conclusions untenable, and I have to bring that to the conversation.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that he mentioned twice, maybe more than twice, but when he was talking about this, he mentioned the issue of money, right? So a lot of money is going to this. And one of the things that I was thinking about just right now is just how that really does affect seminaries, right? And missiology programs, right? Who are we going to send our students to? Who are we going to be sending our, you know, which schools are we going to be enrolling in? And in some ways, if the standard that we measure the school by is grounded in a Zionist worldview, a lot of schools like Gordon Conwell, where he's at right now, or Fuller Seminary, that don't ascribe to this, hermeneutic and worldview, they're not going to be getting the students that are coming from not just the United States, but from around the world. So he's put his finger on something that really is an important, it's an important conversation that we need to be having. And we often don't, because we're worried about being called anti-Semitic or being associated with, that kind of anti-Semitism or a narrative that has in the past itself been very destructive. So I appreciate that he brought up the issue of money. I mean, this is something that who are the missionaries that we're supporting, right? What are the mission works that we're supporting? So it's an important conversation, an important topic.
Well, from there, what else stood out to you, Martin? What grabbed your attention? What was the best in this interview?
Well, one of the other things that I loved is when he's talking about his contributions as a missiologist in the field, he mentions right off the bat his example and the way that he modeled collaboration. And for me, that topic was one of the most exciting, and we need, I was just thinking, you know, as I was interviewing even, I was thinking, this is an important lecture, right? We need to have him do a podcast that's all about how do you collaborate interculturally, right? How do you collaborate in a way that bridges denominations, that is ecumenical, but also bridges cultures and worldviews. So, you know, I guess the best example of this, of course, would be his encyclopedia of, is it the Encyclopedia of Christianity in Asia? What is it? What's it? like a Encyclopedia of Asian Christianity or something like that. But that was a pretty exciting point. I don't know if that stood out to you, Greg.
Yeah, it did, because I thought, I don't know who else has done this kind of, on this scale, collaboration on this scale, cross-culturally, bringing together this variety of scholars from different kinds of backgrounds and different approaches to their subject matter. And it's just a tremendous product, of course, but I'm thinking more about him and the role that he's played and the model that gives us for thinking about, not only do we open up our telling of the history of mission to a belief in the agency of God in history, but we also open up our telling of the history of mission to all of these diverse perspectives and experiences that need to shape Western scholarship, at least from where he's sitting and where I'm sitting, where you're sitting. The need is for our perspective to get broadened. And so he facilitates that. He creates this platform for doing that in a way that is, what do you say, it was like a 7-8 year project? I mean,
that's right. He said and that was his service. And I love that the point that he makes, that this stemmed from a place of love for him, right? This whole project was him sitting with students that weren't as interested in their own histories as they were in the Western histories. And part of that was that they just didn't have access to their stories, and him going, I want you to have access to these stories, your own stories. And so how can I help facilitate that? Right. Is there anything that I can do? And actually there is, right. I can pay for you to show up at the table. And in many ways he's modeling, this microcosm, what we need to be doing across the field. Let's pay for you to come so you can come and talk with us, and let's produce something together collaboratively. You know, us paying as the Westerners for you to show up. We will help orient the conversation, and we are happy to hand most of the writing over to you. We're happy let's make this something that gives you a chance to tell your story. And that encyclopedia does that. And in some ways, it's missiology at its best.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that. I don't know exactly how I'm supposed to feel about this. So I'm just being real honest here. There's a part of it that it's the Dictionary of Asian Christianity. So for you listeners who are going to go out and buy this, there's the correct title. There's an extent to which, of course, this is taking those experiences and stories and fitting them into a Western model of scholarship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a way, it's like, I want that because that enriches and reshapes and transforms Western scholarship concerning Asian Christianity in this case. But on the other hand, I think, so what happens when we fit those stories into this mold?
Mm-hmm.
What's the trade-off? Right. And trade-off is inevitable, and that's the nature of the cross-cultural encounter.
Yeah.
And I know that Dr. Sundquist is more aware of those power dynamics than I am, but I certainly perceive those as I look at this and try to think, what is the best of missiology and the study of world Christianity? How do you do that when the paradigm itself is still Western?
Right.
You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, I mean, he mentions this himself, right? Sundquist mentions that the issue of publications, I mean, who's published and who's not published, it makes a difference in the field, right? It makes a difference even for students that are studying missiology and missions theology in Singapore, right? Who's getting published by the Western publishing companies? And in some ways, we're working within a broken system. And I think that part of what I like about his story is that he's willing to jump into the mess, because you're right. There's no getting around the power dynamics, right? Oh, I'm the one paying for them to show up at the table. That clearly puts me in power, and that's clearly going to, shape some of the conversation. And he's showing up with the outline as well. I mean, he mentioned that, right? I'm showing up with the outline, and I'm saying,
That's right. Yeah, he's forthright about that. He's forthright about that. But I also think it's like, I was just so taken with the comparison between the experience of working with Korean scholars and the experience of working with Indian scholars, and right. how there's this huge learning curve for him even to like, okay, how do I facilitate where it's necessary, but then get out of the way when it's necessary.
Right.
And, yep. And in that sense, I just think, wow, what a tremendous, experience and model for us to contemplate as you know, scholars asking ourselves, how do we move in the 21st century into a more fully inclusive missiological dialogue?
Right.
And so, yeah, it's just, I was so impressed by his work in that regard.
I was too. One of the pictures that is important to take away from that story that he told is the picture of him in India handing the chalk over to an Indian scholar and saying, you write these things down, and him taking a back seat at that point.
Yep.
You know, so he's sitting at the table, and he's no longer the one standing up at the board. He's now sitting at the table. And that becomes, you know, the handing over of the chalk becomes a very important metaphor for us to think through.
Well, it is. And I think it has to stand alongside the metaphor of providing the outline, right? I'm providing the outline, but at the same time, when the moment comes, you take the board, you take the leadership, and I'll learn. Yep.
I like that. And in some ways, you know, even I was talking to my brother, he does psychology, and he's a professor of psychology. And, you know, they're thinking through a lot of these same kind of questions, right? They recognize that, look, we need to be getting a more international perspective. We need a more multicultural, intercultural perspective on our specific fields. And then the struggle of, how do you do that, right? How do you do this in a way that really honors them and their story and doesn't warp their story because, you know, you're showing up with the outline or you're paying the bills. And in some ways, I think that Scott Sundquist's example is just, it's cutting edge, not just for our field. It's really cutting edge for many fields and the way that we do academia in the West.
Completely agree. Cutting edge.
So his connection between spirituality and missiology was another very important topic that he brought up. And it actually hits on a number of different sections of the interview. But his connection between, for instance, you know, that we engage this work of missiology, we engage our scholarship as a spiritual exercise. I just love that. And I love that orientation that he brought to the table. I'm wondering, did that stand out to you as well? Is that something that caught your attention?
Yeah, it did, because I'm very tuned in these days to the question of the relationship between mission scholarship and the spirituality and practice of mission, and the way that those are so often dichotomized at least in the recent history of missions, perhaps you could say Western or American mission history. And there are all kinds of dynamics there that we don't have to go into right now, but because of that dichotomy, I think it's valuable, intriguing, helpful to hear him as a teacher of mission, as a serious scholar, thinking out loud about the meaning of the spiritual experience of his students learning the map and studying history. And, you know, when this extends beyond just missiology and it's almost bizarre, right? But because of the influence and power of the Enlightenment and the way that modernity shaped the academy, all of the theological academy is subject to this kind of dichotomy. And I remember very vividly when I was in the beginning phases of my Master's of Divinity program, a professor set me down and just asked me really straightforwardly, is studying theology a spiritual exercise for you? And I carried that question with me, not because, you know, I didn't have an answer necessarily in the moment, but it was a challenge. The question was a challenge. How much is this entire experience of scholarship and serious study and the transition to practice and keeping theory and practice in this tight relationship that it should be in? How spiritual is all of that? What is that really about? And is God calling you in the midst of that? Is the Spirit moving you and shaping what you do and what you think? And so I was just delighted to hear him talk about that.
I loved it. I think that it's interesting. I don't know if you felt the same way, but as I was listening to him tell the story about his assignment that he gave them, not just to memorize the countries of the world, but to pray over them as well, there was this sense in which he was a little bit embarrassed that he had given this. And he's like, well, I'm not, you know, I don't know. I'd have to go back and listen to his exact wording, but there was a sense of, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done that, but I did this. And hey, turns out that now a person took it seriously and they've been 12 years now on the mission field. That's the person who God called, the one who took this scholarship and this the academic exercise and ran it through the narrative of this, you know, the importance of spirituality in the midst of all of that, the importance of a relationship with God in the midst of that, attuning ourselves to the Spirit and where it is that the Spirit's at work and calling us to, and it shapes you, right? I mean, that kind of practice shapes you, but like you were saying, we have been raised, we have been shaped by a modernist enlightened worldview, right? That says you don't mix those two. I guess I want to see more assignments like that. Maybe I should just say that. You know, I'd like to see people, my professors, give more assignments like that. I remember, it's just as a story, real quick. I remember my first missions course that I ever took. Was a missiology course. It was the Bible and mission, and it was with Charles Van Ingen. And if you've ever taken one of Charles Van Ingen's classes, he may have a 3-hour class that meets once a week, maybe 3.5 hour that meets once a week. But in all of his classes, almost the first hour, at least 45 minutes, are worship. So it's worship and prayer. And that's the first hour. And of course, it drives some people crazy. Like, what are you doing? Why are we spending so much time worshiping? We should be studying these passages. We should be studying these works of history. Let's study the Bible, right? This is the Bible of mission. Why are we spending time worshiping? But, you know, we struggle with that tension. How do we live and hold both of those together? Let's hold our practice, our practices of spirituality and our scholarship and our practices of research, and let's hold those together. I'm curious, Greg, this is just like a total side note. We may completely cut this out, but your professor asked you if for you studying theology, you know, was a spiritual discipline, a spiritual practice for you. I'm curious what that looks like for you, because my guess is that you said yes, but I'm curious what that actually looked like.
Yeah, my response was yes, and it was an honest response, but I really did take that and continue thinking about it, and I like the metaphor of leaning into the meaning of that question. Mm-hmm. as I returned to my, you know, mad dash to complete assignments and get term papers turned in, and that's the thing about what it actually looks like is, in the midst of the frantic labor of scholarship, where you're trying to do really good A quality work and learn how to be a scholar in a master's program, and of course this transfers to terminal studies as well, you can get lost in just the doing of it,
right?
And it becomes work, you know, and methodological questions aside, it can just be overwhelmingly a task that you have to do and achievements that you make and keeping your scholarship and whatever, whatever the case may be.
Right. Yeah. Got to get tenure.
And yeah. And so for me, it was, I'll borrow a word from liberation theology. The question conscientized me to the stakes of what I was doing. And it made me regularly stop in the midst of reading hundreds of pages and ask myself, who is this God and what is my relationship to this God that I'm learning about? And what does this have to do with the world that I really live in and the people that I minister to? And, it's not, you know, it's really not about how much I learn what kind of paper I'm able to produce out of this, but the significance of this is real because God is real. This is a living God.
That's right.
And and all of this reflection and the mental labor that goes into this is an act of devotion. And that's what it became for me. It became even, it's weird to think about it this way, and I don't know if anybody else does, but I really do, as I am reading tomes of academic theology, I think of it as an act of prayer. Mm. And I try to keep my mind and my heart engaged in thinking God and thinking toward God as I do that. Rather than just, you know, like trying to intersperse actual prayer. That's great. And of course you should be a prayerful person, but for me, the exercise itself is the exercise of reading and study and writing, is somehow to be transformed into a spiritual act of worship, you know, in a way that's meaningful to me.
I like that.
So that's what it is for me.
For me, this has been, a lonelier time in my life, working for the last 6 months on my dissertation, and it involves hours of reading and writing all by myself. And I've struggled with this, you know, what I don't want to, my life feels like I'm a monk right now. It feels so distant from reality. One of the ways.
I think actually the problem might be that your life doesn't feel like you're a monk.
Right, because, exactly.
Because monks lived in that community and had those regular rhythms of like.
They didn't have kids.
Of being together and worship. Yeah.
Than a six-year-old going, hey, daddy, papa, let's play.
Do you want to build a snowman?
Right. Right. So it's the Jesuits that we really have to blame for all of this. But so the one of the things that I've tried to do just as a very simple practice, and honestly, I wish that my dissertation could have been a much more, to use, you know, a very important word for Scott Sundquist, is collaborative, right? I would love for this to have been a more dialogical process. You know, I try to think of myself as dialoguing with these books and with the people that I'm, the scholars that I'm engaging. But one of the simple things that I've done is just is standing up and walking around the block and praying and asking, you know, what is it, God, that you're drawing my attention to in what I'm reading? And that's just been a very simple practice. It's something that reminds me that this is not just scholarship, right? This is spirituality.
I think the renewing of our minds looks like a lot of different things, and certainly it is not exclusively the kind of work that we do in a PhD program, but I think it should include that kind of work. I think that kind of transformation of our minds and our hearts, our wills, that comes through the prolonged engagement with the hearts and minds of others and, you know, externalized as texts, is important. It's important for the church. It's a function that we serve as a part of the body, as scholars.
Yeah. And I think one of the, you know, getting to one of the ways that Sundquist talks about this is through, well, he was talking about his book, Understanding Christian Mission, and his editor helping him realize that part of what he's offering here in this book is, an understanding of mission. Well, his editor said, this is Christian existence as mission existence. You know, this is all about this book. Part of what makes it unique and part of Scott Sundquist's contribution in this sense, the spirituality scholarship connection, is that he's interpreted all of his life, everything that happens is life in the Trinity, right? This is a missional life because I'm living life in the Trinity, and that means that everything that I do is suddenly, potentially at least, a spiritual act. You know, everything that I'm doing is potentially something that can sharpen my awareness, raise my awareness to God's Spirit and presence and work in my life. And then also, potentially, if I'm responsive to that, even, you know, heighten my ability or grow my ability to join in what the Spirit is doing around me. So I appreciate that as well, right? So all of this lands within this framework of Christian existence is mission existence.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So here's another connection. In this whole conversation, it seems like possibly one way to put it is that the question is, where does your mission scholarship come from? What is it rooted in? What is it growing out of?
Right.
For me, the most vivid image in the interview was David Bosch, the great mission scholar of the end of the 20th century, the one who set the terms of the conversation for the next 35 years, on his knees, begging God for an understanding of what he should do in his vocation and praying for Blacks in South Africa in the midst of their oppression and turmoil. And then, you know, Scott sharing that with us is so, so rich and valuable, because it gives us as listeners the chance to recognize that watershed missiology, that great act of scholarship, comes out of that spirituality. And I just love that. I love knowing that it's rooted there, that you don't expect to do what Bosch did unless it's done from one's knees.
That's right. His missiology is birthed of love. That was one of his things that he said about Bosch. He said his missiology was birthed of love, and it was all about laying down life for his friends, right? Laying down his life for his friends. And that's what inspired, that's where his scholarship, you know, that's what bubbled out of his scholarship. I should say that his scholarship bubbled out of that, right? That love, that willingness to lay down life for his friends. He's, you know, David Bosch was a man who, you know, from the little pictures that we got from Scott, he's a man who lived his existence was a Christian existence. His Christian existence was a mission existence. Anyway, I love that as well. I love that picture that he gave us of David Bosch, and especially I think considering the fact that David Bosch and his book Transforming Mission, published in, you know, 1991, that this book has come up in I think every single one of the interviews that we've done so far.
Yeah,
it's either been mentioned as someone who is, you know, a book or a text or a person who's been a significant influence in their development as missiologists, or they've brought him up as in his text up as, you know, this is something that, you know, my career, my contributions, I can trace them back to when I read David Bosch, you know, for the first time.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's an astonishing thread that's appeared over the course of the season. And in some ways, not surprising to either of us. We've read Bosch. We know this is a watershed work of missiology that most people can't stop talking about. In some ways, you know, all of missiology in the last few decades has been trying to say something more than Bosch, and
hey, that's good. Yes,
trying to find where are the little holes that we can tear into and move into whatever the new paradigm really is. But it's nice to know that scholarship is rooted in that spirituality, that love,
yeah,
and that actual practice of mission.
You know, one of the ways that Scott models this, you know, scholarship, spirituality, you know, living in that that narrative is every time I heard him speak, every time he spoke to us, whether in a classroom, at a PhD It could have been a conversation or a discussion around a certain text, whatever it was. I mean, sometimes it was him standing up for a lecture. Almost every single time, I think it was every single time, he started out with, here's a passage that I read this morning, and let me tell you what I think God is telling us from this passage, and let me tell you what I'm taking from this for my own life and how it's shaping me today and my thoughts today. I love that Scott Sundquist is a person who, like David Bosch, is writing scholarship, is writing his missiology from a place of deep love for God and love for others.
This was good. We've got one more episode in this season. It's going to be our kind of meta discussion. So this was a great one to wrap up the regular interviews with, and we'll get to talk more about your conversation with Mark Lyle Branson in the next one.
Mark Branson. So my own mentor. He's my dissertation advisor.
So I have very high expectations for that one.
We're going to be really nice in our post game. So we'll be with Mark Branson next podcast. And he's going to be talking all about appreciative inquiry and his journey with appreciative inquiry. For those of you who, this is maybe your first podcast, we use an appreciative inquiry approach to this entire podcast season. And we'd love to let you in on a little bit of why we did that and what we were thinking, how the questions that we asked emerged from our conversations. And anyway, join us for that.
Cool. Well, we will catch you next time then.
Thank you for joining us.